Oh, wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab, and today we're gonna tiptoe into some territory that's sort of new for us, new-ish, which is we're gonna talk about legal battles at the Supreme Court.
And we're gonna bring you two stories from the Supreme Court. One is actually from our new spin-off show that Jad is doing, which, if you haven't heard, is called More Perfect, and it's a mini-series dedicated to the Supreme Court. If you like the piece you're gonna hear at the end of this episode, you should totally check it out at radiolab.org/moreperfect.
Okay, but first, to get us rolling, we have the story of a little girl who became a very, very big deal.
How big a deal did this little girl become?
A very big deal to about 500-something nations. And Tim Howard, our intrepid producer, is going to tell us this story.
So I first heard about this story. I saw it listed on the Supreme Court docket for cases that they were going to be hearing.
Well, the name of the case is Baby Girl versus Adoptive Couple.
Actually, in strict legal parlance, it's called Adoptive Couple v. Baby Girl.
So it's not a particularly catchy name.
I gotta say, it's a weird name, though. It's hard to picture.
Yeah.
So this is Marcia Zug,
associate professor of law at the University of South Carolina.
And she wrote about this case in Slate. And it stood out to me because, you know, it just seemed odd at first that this would even be a Supreme Court case. It seemed more like a straightforward custody case.
Right.
But when you dig in.
Yeah. There's a lot going on here.
Crusades.
Text messages.
State laws.
Errors.
Children.
Supreme Court.
Christopher Columbus.
Christopher Columbus.
And it is not straightforward at all.
Apparently not.
So let me walk you through it the way that I learned about it. The story begins with a couple.
Matt and Melanie Capobianco, they are a couple who live down here in South Carolina.
He's a technician at Boeing. She's a developmental psychologist.
Nice middle-class white couple.
They're in their late 30s.
And
they really wanted to have a kid.
They had gone through, infertility problems. So
eventually,
they decide to adopt.
Enter a woman named Chrissy Maldonado. She lives about 1,000 miles away.
I believe she's in Oklahoma.
She's in her 20s, already has a couple kids.
She's pregnant and decides that she wants to give the baby up for adoption, and she picks the Capobiancos. And everyone seems happy.
The Capobiancos get the baby, and they name her Veronica.
We used to call her Boss Lady. Not a lot. Most of the time it was...
Our family called her that.
Yeah.
Boss Lady.
Bosses everybody around.
This is Matt and Melanie Capobianco.
But you were happy to do whatever she told you to do, because she's just the poster child for a proud father, you know? But it's just gone as wrong as it could have possibly gone.
This is basically how it unfolded on TV news.
Back in session on the docket today, a young child ripped from the arms of the only parents she's ever known.
And turned over to the Native American biological father she has never met.
A man Veronica had never even met.
What happened is when Veronica was 2,
her biological dad turned up
seemingly out of nowhere. And according to these clips, hadn't been around for 2 years, had abandoned the child, and now he's asking for custody. And he gets it.
And the court is making them stand by and just let it happen.
Wait, why?
Well, it's mainly because of this law.
The Indian Child Welfare Act.
The 1978 Indian Child Welfare Act.
Dustin, the dad, he's Cherokee.
He's a part of the Cherokee Nation.
So that makes his daughter, Veronica, eligible to be Cherokee. And the law is designed
to keep Indian families together.
It gives preference to Indian kids staying with Indian parents. So even though he'd actually signed papers agreeing to the adoption, he was able to invoke this law and get custody of Veronica.
He signed his custody away, and he was able to then use his Cherokee-ness to reverse the rights he signed away?
Just hang on.
All right.
This is all going to make sense.
Okay, but he takes the kid, is what you're saying.
Yeah. New Year's Eve 2011, with cameras rolling, Dustin Brown drives his pickup truck into Charleston.
Matt and Melody Capobianco clutch to 2-year-old Veronica. This could possibly be the last time they hold their baby as her mom and dad.
And that evening, Veronica is transferred to Dustin.
I didn't feel like we had enough time for her to be not afraid when she's...
We left her with strangers.
Yeah, when she's... I mean, to her, they're complete strangers, and I can't imagine that she's not going to be terrified.
And as Dustin gets into the truck, holding his two-year-old daughter for the first time, a reporter asks him,
"Do you think this is in her best interest?"
And this is all you hear from him.
"I think so.
Let's get back, please.
We need to give her a
chance
again.
Have you ever seen the child before?"
They declined any further comment on camera.
He gets into the truck with Veronica, and they drive away, back to Oklahoma. Can I ask you, when was the last time that you spoke with Veronica?
The day after,
Transfer.
We spoke to her for about 2 minutes, and we told her we loved her, and she said, "I love you, Mommy, and I love you, Daddy." And
that was 16 months ago.
And how long was Veronica with them again before this happened?
About 2 years.
Oh, man, that's hard.
Yeah. And, you know, when I first heard about this case, that's basically the only way I thought of it, you know, is just,
yeah,
that's a crazy injustice. That's basically all I saw in it.
I mean, if you're someone who has no background in this, then you see a case like the baby Veronica case, and you're like, whoa, where is this coming from? How can this possibly be okay?
That's Marcia Zug again. And her article for Slate kind of caught me off guard because the title was Doing What's Best for the Tribe. Two-year-old Veronica was ripped from the only home she's ever known. The court made the right decision.
Yeah. So one of the things that's, I think, important to realize is that the problems that ICWA was intended to address didn't stop happening that long ago.
And this is where the story turned into the biggest rabbit hole I've ever fallen into.
What did she tell you?
I mean, Marcia basically said the only way you can begin to wrap your mind around what's right and what's wrong in this story is to go back to the 60s.
Bert, how you doing?
Good, how are you, Tim?
Great to meet you.
Same here.
And to this guy.
Bert Hirsch. I'm a lawyer.
He lives in Long Island now, which is where I visited him. But in 1967...
The fall of 67, I was on the staff of the Association on American Indian Affairs.
Sort of a legal advocacy group for American Indians. And he traveled all over, working with different tribes.
And
one day, he gets a phone call from this guy, Lewis Goodhouse.
The tribal chair of the Devil's Lake Sioux Tribe in North Dakota.
And this guy says, "I really need your help."
He said, "There's a child."
A Devil's Lake kid, one of ours, that was just abruptly taken away by social workers.
The Benson County, North Dakota Social Services Agency came in and they took little Ivan Brown away from his grandmother.
He was six. What was their stated reason for taking Ivan away?
Neglect.
Because what? Because grandma wasn't around?
No, actually, Bert says that the social workers were looking for that classic nuclear family.
Biological mother, biological father, children.
So when they saw him with an older relative, but no mom or dad, they thought, uh-oh. And they took him away.
The tribal council was extremely upset by this. They wanted to fight a battle about this.
Bert took the case, fought it in court.
We won that case, by the way. At Mrs. Alex Fornia, she got Ivan back.
But he began to wonder, how widespread is this?
So from 67 to the end of 68 into 69...
He visited
tribe after tribe after tribe.
Doing interviews. And he says that everywhere he went, he would hear these stories.
I remember it vividly.
This is Deb Wells. She's a member of the Rosebud Sioux tribe. And when she was 10 years old, a car pulled into her driveway.
Somebody come driving in, social workers, and they got out of the car. And I told my brothers and sisters, I said, "Go hide." And they had to drag us out from underneath the bed because we got around and got in the house. So then they took us to Scott's Bluff and put us in a foster home. It was horrible.
This was just part of every Native family's history.
This is Marla Jean Big Boy. She grew up on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota.
I remember when I was young, we'd go to one of the border towns and my grandma would say, "Stay in the car, lock yourself in, don't get out of the car. I'm going into the trading post because they're going to steal you."
Really?
Yeah.
What we found is that on every reservation...
My name is Michael Evan Nohart. I'm a full-blood Unpapa Lakota from Standing Rock Reservation.
You couldn't not find a family that didn't know of a child in placement.
The social services came and took me and my sister and told my mother and dad that they were taking us into Mobridge for a physical checkup, and they never brought us back.
Wow.
Michael says that his dad spent the next 30 years looking for him. In any case, Bert would ask these people that he was interviewing, what reason did the social workers give you for taking the child? And the answers that he got ran the gamut.
Conditions of poverty, alcoholism.
Overcrowding.
Maybe they don't have adequate ventilation in the house.
No indoor plumbing. But in most cases, he says, the reasons wouldn't have stood up in court.
If they could, they tried to fight it.
But they usually couldn't afford to.
You know, look, the tribal people are poor. So we began to do a statistical collection of data, state by state.
Asking how many Indian kids are in foster care.
Foster care and adoptive placement and institutional placement, juvenile facilities.
And what he arrived at the end of that analysis is a pretty shocking number.
About one-third of Indian children were in out-of-home placements in non-Indian settings.
Wow. One-third?
25 to 35% of Indian children nationwide were in out-of-home placements.
That's a real number?
That is the real number. That's the number you see cited again and again.
Everybody thought that it was their own personal tragedy. Nobody realized that this was a pattern and a practice that was decimating these tribes.
Wait a second. How would this happen on this scale?
Well, this is basically social workers very much acting in the spirit of the day. Because you have to keep in mind that in the 50s and 60s, you have all these government policies that are put in place whose entire purpose is basically to try to once and for all solve this Indian problem that's gone on and on. You've got this guy in 1953 who's a senator from Utah who starts basically trying to terminate the tribes.
You mean like take away their sovereignty?
Yeah. He goes tribe to tribe trying to convince them or force them, tell them they have no, there's no way out of it. He argues that this will be best for all of them.
I remember this. This was like out of E Pluribus Unum, like to integrate them into the whole.
They will melt into the wider culture. That's what will save them. Part of the social workers that were working in this period, they were working under the auspices of this thing called the Indian Adoption Project, which was very much about that idea of like, you take these kids from their poor conditions and you connect them directly to white families that are looking to adopt.
So part of this was definitely top down.
Very much. In any case, the end result of this is that a third of these kids are being taken away.
There were literally communities where there were no children.
That's Terry Cross. He's the executive director of the National Indian Child Welfare Association.
In Minnesota, there were communities where there were no children. In Alaska, there were communities where there were no children.
I mean, what is a culture except, you know, the ideas and traditions that you pass on to your kids?
That's Marcia Zug again.
If you are hemorrhaging your children, then you're going to disappear.
So what do you do?
Well, it's too massive a problem if you're trying to fight all these removals of kids on a case-by-case basis. Forget about it. A national law is needed.
So Bert spent years
walking the halls of Congress, literally.
Endless lobbying, congressional hearings, until finally
the Indian Child Welfare Act is passed by Congress in 1978.
So it does a lot, but basically when it comes to adoptions,
ICWA has placement preferences. So the first preference would be with the immediate family. So you're removed from mom, you're placed with dad, or maybe with grandmother.
If they say no.
Second preference would be someone else in the tribe. And the third is any other American Indian.
Wow. Any other?
Yeah.
And then after that, then the child could be placed with, you know, another family. By and large, most of us think that ICWA was probably the best federal Indian law ever passed. It did the most to help Indian tribes, respect tribal sovereignty, and really fulfill the United States' trust relationship with American Indian people.
But now, because of this case, that law may be in jeopardy.
We'll continue in a moment.
This is Jean Pelletier in Boston, Massachusetts. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krilwich.
This is Radiolab. Today, a look at a Supreme Court case that may determine the future of a law called the Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA. The story comes from producer Tim Howard. Back to him.
So in April, I went to this conference in Tulsa.
The Board of Directors, Council of Elders.
Big room. There were 700 people there. Most of them work in child welfare organizations in Indian communities around the country.
Native communities.
There was some traditional Cherokee drumming. There were films, workshops. And all anybody could talk about was this case.
But there is no issue bigger now than how the Baby Veronica case may affect the Indian Child Welfare Act.
So please, please do keep Baby Veronica and her family in your prayers.
Everybody was on edge.
Well, I'm really worried in this situation.
This is Terry Cross again. He's one of the organizers. And he told me that, look, the Capo Biancos.
I feel for them. But in what world is it okay for one family who feels they were damaged by a law to put thousands of other children at jeopardy for their own hurt? I can't imagine a world where that's okay.
Well, I mean, it's hard for us to say that because, you know, that's not what motivated us.
Our daughters, what's motivating us?
How we feel, we just feel that in this case, it was a beautiful law that was put into place to prevent the breakup of families, Indian families. And I just think it wasn't really supposed to be applied to a situation like ours.
They say, but we get that there's a huge historical wrong here, but what does that have to do with us? You know, yeah. They say this is a law that was created to protect Indian families, right?
Yeah.
But here you've got a Hispanic birth mom, you got a white couple, and then you got a dad who's out of the picture. So you're not actually protecting an Indian family, you're forcibly creating a new one.
Absolutely. I mean,
and in the process, you're breaking up a loving home.
I don't think that was the intent of the law ever.
My personal opinion is that ICWA has outlived its usefulness and causes more problems than it solves.
This is Mark Fidler.
I'm one of the attorneys for Matt and Melanie Capo Bianco.
He also happens to be Native American himself.
I'm an enrolled member of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Indians. That's a reservation up in North Dakota, right on the border with Canada. You know, so I kind of had a foot in two cultures, so to speak. I'd go back to the res in the summer. And
Mark actually used to argue the other side, that the most important thing was to keep Indian families together. But then
I had a case in, I think it was 94.
Which gave him pause.
Ah, boy. That's a good word.
It was a case in which this young American Indian girl,
Sierra,
wanted to be adopted by this white couple, and Mark opposed it.
Even though in my heart of hearts, I knew it was probably not the right thing for the child.
He won the case. She was removed from the couple's home.
And as Sierra would tell you herself, she had a really rough life.
She bounced in and out of more than 20 foster homes, ran away many, many times, and got into serious trouble with the law.
And it always nagged me.
Mark says even though the tribes have suffered, that doesn't change the fact that if you take a kid out of a loving home, you're going to cause her real harm. And he says that's why he took this case.
Because the Capo Biancos, you know, they are among the most loving people I know.
He says they did everything you could ask.
They're just amazing people.
They met the birth mother, Christy Maldonado, when she was pregnant. They got to know her.
She felt a connection to them.
That's Lori McGill. She's represented Christy since last year.
And they were also willing to have an open adoption.
Yeah, we still have a relationship with Christy. We love her to death.
And Christy gave birth to Veronica.
They were there with her in the delivery room.
Yeah, I mean, the day she was born, I cut the cord.
That's such a degree of intimacy that I
know.
Find.
I mean, having given birth twice myself, the idea that anyone other than my husband would be in the room is kind of scary. But that it gives you some idea of how she felt about the Capo Biancos.
Now, as for Dustin Brown, Veronica's biological dad, a couple months before she was born, Christy, the birth mom, sent him a text message asking him
if he wants to pay child support or he wants to waive his rights.
And he replied, I'll waive my rights.
Rather than pay a dime in child support.
Well, there's the contrast. So in the beginning, it sounds like he did not want to be a dad.
Yeah, and then actually, a few months later, he seems to make it even more official by signing a form agreeing to the adoption.
And then he changes his mind?
Yeah, you know, and obviously I was wondering, what was he thinking? Because you can't avoid the fact that how you feel about this guy is going to influence how you feel about this law.
Yeah.
And so I was trying to get in touch with him. I was pestering his lawyers, you know, will he do an interview? This went on for weeks, and they were basically like, he doesn't want to do interviews. He doesn't want to talk.
Yeah, yeah, so you didn't get him.
Yeah, I got him.
Good.
So, shortly before we were going to wrap this story, I get an email saying, come to Oklahoma. So I went. He lives in this one-story house on this tree-lined block in a small town north of Tulsa.
Hey, how's it going?
How are we doing? Good. Doing good.
Okay.
We go inside, and the first thing he tells me is that Veronica's not there.
Oh, no. She's excited to meet her.
She was out with his wife, Robin.
She goes out with my wife.
Turns out he's remarried. In any case,
test, all right.
We sat down at the kitchen table and started talking.
Do you mind do you mind introducing yourself and telling me like where we are?
I'm Dustin Brown. We're in Knowwhat, Oklahoma. This is my house. I'm part of the Wolf Clan.
Wolf Clan is one of the seven Cherokee clans.
And my name, Dustin, means brave warrior in Cherokee. And actually, you know, join the army up and go over to Iraq. I'm like, wow, I'm here for the Cherokees. I'm the brave warrior out in, you know, desert.
He's been a registered member since he was a little kid. His parents were members and their parents. And he said he's proud to be Cherokee, basically because it means that he's from where he lives.
It's a big deal to me.
So anyway, we started talking about the case, and, you know, it gets complicated. There's a lot of detail. I'm not going to go into all of it. But basically, he and Christy Maldonado, the birth mom...
We've known each other since we were 16. We've dated off and on. Throughout
2008, he joins the Army.
Basic training.
He lives on a base. It's 4 hours away.
4 hours south of...
And Christmas time that year, he basically says, let's get serious.
Got down on one knee and proposed to her, said, hey, I want to bring you into my life. She said, okay, that's just great. And almost a month later, she sent me a message saying that she was pregnant, and I was excited. I mean, to have children with her was one of the things I wanted at that time. Told her I can move you and your kids up to the base. Housing was going to be free on base. There were schools for her kids. She could get a job right there on base, you know. Everything was taken care of. I mean, everything was going great, you know.
And then... pretty quickly, the whole thing just soured. It's impossible to know exactly what happened, but Christy says that Dustin just simply didn't offer any support. He says that he did, or he tried to at least, but shortly after she got pregnant, she basically just shut him out, stopped taking his calls.
I didn't get no phone calls, no text messages, nothing from her out of the blue, and I'm just like, well, what's going on?
And he says that he tried to get in touch with her.
Texting her up, trying to call her. Still no answer. There's a couple times that I've went back to Bartlesville, went to her house.
Drove those 4 hours from the base.
Knocked on her door. I could hear, you know, voices in the house. It sounded like her and the kids. They wouldn't answer the door for me.
And then one day he says...
she sent me a message saying, I don't want to be with you no more.
And 3 weeks after that...
she's like, well, I want you to sign your rights over.
His parental rights.
Would you sign your rights over?
You guys are texting this, or are you talking?
Oh, the whole time we're text messaging this because she wouldn't talk to me.
And what did you think it meant?
To me, I just thought she wanted me to sign my rights over to her. And I'm like, this is something I really don't want to do.
He says she kept texting him that question. And looming in his mind was the fact that he just learned
that we were going to be going to Iraq to... do a radar mission, so...
And he starts to wonder, what's the right thing to do here?
You know, if there was one of them chances I wasn't going to come back, I wanted to make the right choice and let the mother be that sole parent.
And he says that he's holding out hope, that if he does make it back...
we'll get back together and she'll just change her mind. Finally, I just told her, I was like, all right, I'll sign my rights over.
Months go by. Christy has the baby. He says he doesn't know exactly when because they weren't speaking. But then...
6 days before... I had to go deploy to Iraq. I get a phone call from some guy in Washington County.
A process server.
Said, hey, we need you to sign some papers so you can sign your custody rights over.
And the guy directed him to an office right near the base.
Went there and signed the paper. And
what did you think it meant?
The whole time I thought it was just, you know, the paperwork for me signing custody rights to her. But when I got done signing, the guy said, "You just signed your rights away, and so did the biological mother. The baby's been up for adoption. She's been living in South Carolina for 4 months."
Dustin says this is the first moment that he realized what was actually happening, that the baby was up for adoption, and he says that he had no idea he had just legally consented to it.
I should have had a lawyer there with me. At that point in time, I grabbed the paper, and the guy looked at me and said, "If you're going to rip that up," he said, it's not good to do that.
That he could be arrested.
And I said, "What do I got to do?" He said, "You need to get a lawyer."
Which he immediately did. And that's why the courts have ruled in his favor, because they say that from that moment, he's clearly demonstrated that he wants to be her dad.
I mean, I never once did I want to give up on my daughter. Never once did I want to give her up. I mean, everybody says that I gave her up. Never wanted to.
Now, Mark and Lori say that if this were any other guy,
any other man of any other race,
the story would be over right about here.
It's too late.
He wouldn't have any rights at all.
Under every state's laws, too late. Under the federal constitution, too late. He rejected that opportunity to become a father.
But he has one thing in his favor, says Lori. He happens to be Cherokee. And because of that fact,
not only can this sort of man object, but he gets an automatic transfer of custody to him.
And Mark and Lori see that as basically the worst kind of preferential treatment.
And that is unbelievable.
This is John.
John Nichols.
This is Shannon.
Shannon Jones.
And they're two of Dustin's lawyers. And John says, okay, there's preferential treatment.
Fine. But
think about why all the protections of ICWA are there.
These roadblocks are there for a reason.
We went over this earlier, but, you know, basically people are being manipulated out of their kids. And while you might like to think that that's ancient history,
now fast forward to 2010.
He says the same thing is happening in this case.
And we have a registered member of the Cherokee Nation. We have his child being given up for adoption without his knowledge and without his consent.
And they kept this adoption from him for months and then spring it on him 6 days before he leaves the country?
It looks to us like it was engineered to make sure he got served, but not in enough time to where he could put up a fight.
I believe it was absolutely intentional.
And Shannon suggests that they knew about ICWA, they knew it would apply, and they were trying to sidestep it.
There were so many errors.
You just did a little air quotes on errors, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. Because, I mean,
like, for example, there's this one important form where Shannon says that they went out of their way to make it look like Veronica is not Native American.
Because it would be detrimental to the adoption.
That's just, it's a preposterous argument. You know, the form.
Mark and Laurie say the reason that nobody put Cherokee in big, bright, flaming letters is simple.
Christy herself is predominantly Hispanic. Dustin is predominantly Caucasian and is approximately 2% Cherokee.
What? Did she say 2%?
Yeah, Veronica herself would be a little bit over 1%.
Wait, this whole thing is happening because he's only 2%?
Well,
I feel like that changes things somehow.
Well, yeah, but you have to keep in mind that Cherokee Nation doesn't care about the percentage of Cherokee in your blood. That's not how they determine their members.
Being a member of the Cherokee Nation is like being a member of the United States. You are a citizen of the nation.
You know, if your parents are U.S. citizen, you're automatically a citizen.
That's Chrissy Nemo, Assistant Attorney General for Cherokee Nation.
If your parents are Cherokee citizen, you're not automatically a citizen.
But you can automatically apply. So it's based on direct lineage. But still, you're right, because this is the argument that is most troubling to the tribes. Both Chrissy Nemo and Marcia Zug told me that if the Supreme Court ends up deciding that
ICWA is unconstitutional because it really is race-based.
Unconstitutional because it's a race-based preference.
It calls into question every single federal Indian law.
Ow, there goes Indian law.
This is a case that they could use to do that.
If ICWA falls because it's unconstitutional, it could have a crazy domino effect.
Every single federal Indian law is premised on giving some sort of special treatment to Indians.
What would that mean concretely if Indian law were to go away?
It means that their policing, their court system, their education, anything they do as a sovereign nation, all of that just evaporates. And, you know, like a tribe would just become another group of people on some land. Huh. That said, this is not the likely outcome. Now, the Supreme Court will probably rule as narrowly as they possibly can. And as far as the tribes are concerned, they can do a lot of damage to the law without calling it unconstitutional. You know, they could allow for this certain kind of exception to ICWA, which would make it a lot easier for people like the Capobiancos to adopt.
So they could rule any number of ways.
Yeah. And the thing is that it's all strangely connected to this three-year-old girl.
The whole time through this, I'm thinking I'm just going to sign custody rights over.
So when she finally showed up halfway through my interview with Dustin.
Hello. Hi.
It was kind of surreal.
This yeah. is my daughter, Veronica, though.
Daddy.
Hey, Veronica. I'm Tim.
She's got dark curly hair. She's this ball of energy.
She's definitely bullheaded.
And within a minute, she's giving me a tour of every single object in her room.
And this.
I mean, everything.
Who's that?
Army bear.
Army bear. You got one of Daddy's dog tags on it?
Yeah.
She was a very, very proud host.
Is that my brother?
A few minutes later, she wanted to show me her geese.
I don't think I've seen geese in a long time.
You're about to.
I'm about to. Are these your
ducks? Those are real geese?
Yeah.
Hey, babies!
She feeds them out of her hand.
No, don't mess with that water. Come here, babies.
Thomas! Thomas Train!
Thomas the Train?
Yes.
Yep.
So, what could happen to her?
Are they eating?
Well, if the Supreme Court said Dustin Brown shouldn't have qualified as father under ICWA, what they do is they would send it back down to a South Carolina court, and then they would have this new best interest evaluation. Basically, like, what's the best thing for her at this point? She's been with him now for about a year and a half, and so that actually might really change the calculation. Honestly, hanging out with her and Dustin in the backyard is really easy to forget. All these people whose lives are just completely tangled up in this scene, but who aren't there? Christy Maldonado, the birth mom.
She did not intend to give Veronica up. She intended to give Veronica a life.
Matt and Melanie Capobianco.
I mean, this has been going on for so long. We've kind of been in a holding pattern for forever.
We're just waiting and waiting and waiting.
And of course, the hundreds of tribes who are just worried about their own kids.
Pretty cool. Are you a good swimmer?
Yes. I'm a good swimmer.
I'm a bad swimmer.
You're not. You're a good swimmer.
No, I'm a pretty bad swimmer.
No, you're not. You're a good swimmer.
How do you know I'm a good swimmer?
I know you're a good swimmer. You're a good swimmer.
Well, I appreciate that.
So the Supreme Court came to a decision on this ruling about a month after we first aired this podcast, and here's what they said.
Okay, so the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 in favor of the adoptive couple, which is to say against the birth father.
So Dustin Brown, the dad, lost.
Right.
It was like a 60-page ruling, and not being totally confident what all the ramifications were, I just made some calls.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you? For example, I Skyped with Marcia Zug, who you remember from the piece.
Mm-hmm.
She's a law professor at the University of South Carolina. Can you walk me through what this opinion means?
Well, in terms of Veronica's placement, had it come out the other way, then it would be over. She would stay with Dustin Brown, her biological father. End of story.
Mm-hmm.
What we have now is the court upholding the termination of his parental rights.
So basically, the Supreme Court ruled that Dustin Brown shouldn't have been allowed to invoke the Indian Child Welfare Act because he didn't have what's called continuing custody of Veronica.
Continuing custody.
Right. They argue that this law is about preventing the breakup of Indian families, and there was no Indian family here because they didn't live together.
The dad and the daughter didn't live together.
Right. Yeah. So they don't scrap the Indian Child Welfare Act. They just say that it shouldn't apply in a case like this.
So basically, according to Tim, it was a pretty narrow ruling. What then happened is that the Supreme Court kicked the case down to a lower court in South Carolina, and that lower court ultimately awarded custody of Veronica to the Capobiancos. Dustin Brown tried to fight it. There were lots of lawsuits flying back and forth in both directions. But in the end, Veronica did end up going to the Capobiancos.
It's been 2.5 weeks since our daughter Veronica left with Matt and Melanie Capobianco.
And on October 10th, 2013, Dustin Brown called a press conference.
It was the love for my daughter that kept me going all this time. But it was also the love for my daughter that finally gave me the strength to accept things that are beyond my control. The time has come for me to let Veronica live a normal childhood that was so desperately needed and deserves.
Dustin Brown then announced that he would be stopping his custody battle for good.
And to Veronica, one day you will read about this time in your life. Never, ever, for one second, never, ever, for one second, doubt how much I love you. How hard I fought for you, or how much you mean to me. My home will always be your home, and always welcome in it. I miss you more than words can express. You'll always be my little girl, my princess, and I will always love you until the day I die.
One more thing. In our story, we talked a lot about the possibility, sort of the larger possibility, that from the tribe's perspective, this case could be used as a first step to basically declare Indian law as a race-based situation that could then be negated. That didn't happen in this case. But there is this sense that they kind of planted a seed. For example, Justice Alito, who wrote the ruling, he starts it off with mention of Veronica being, you know, 1.2% Cherokee, which is interesting because it sounds like he's about to make an argument for why this is a race-based preference and why it's a violation of equal protection. But then he doesn't make that argument. He pulls back, according to Tim. And so the question is, why did he start the ruling that way? Was he trying to send a message of some kind?
I asked Marcia what she thought about it. Why do you think they started it off that way?
I've been thinking about that. It clearly sat wrong with at least some members of the court. I mean, when listening to the oral arguments, you could tell that. You know, Roberts harped on it as well. I think it's an indication that at least some members of the court have serious reservations about Indian law because they just don't see Veronica as an Indian child. To them, Indian is a race, and she doesn't have enough blood to be of that race. It's a possible indication of where future Indian law cases are going to go. I don't know.
Since then, the Supreme Court has seen a handful of Indian law cases, and the biggest development so far is that the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the federal government have changed the rules surrounding the Indian Child Welfare Act, or they're about to. The new rule changes are going to go into effect December 2016. What it will mean is that when a child like Veronica is put up for adoption, the state would have to ask whether or not she was an Indian child. The father would have to have been asked whether or not she was an Indian child. And the state would not be able to consider what percentage Indian blood she has in determining if she is an Indian child. Obviously, the hope is that future Veronicas will not have to go through what this Veronica went through. But we'll see. Huge thanks to Tim Howard, who now produces the amazing podcast Reply All. They just put out a 4-part series on the criminal justice system. It's called On the Inside. Definitely check it out. Coming up next, a segment from, as Robert mentioned at the top, our first ever spinoff that we just launched called More Perfect. And in it, we tell stories about the Supreme Court, sort of like the one you just heard. So after the break, I want to play the first part of our first episode for you. And if you dig it, I hope you'll think about subscribing, which you can do at radiolab.org/moreperfect. Stay tuned.
Hey there. This is Bethany Barton in Los Angeles, California. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Three, two, one. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich. This is still Radiolab.
Indeed. And for our final segment, we're going to play you an excerpt from Radiolab's very first new spinoff called More Perfect. And
here we go.
Yeah.
More Perfect.
Can we watch Teletubbies for a second? Although that's also horrifying.
It's true. One, two. Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad. This is More Perfect, a mini-series that we're just getting going about some of the ideas and the cases that flow through the Supreme Court. And we're going to start the series off with a story that isn't so much a courtroom drama. This one is about an issue that I think everybody agrees is about to land at the Supreme Court again in a big way. The story comes from reporter Karen Duffin, and it begins with a mystery.
Right.
All right, so we're starting with Maya, right?
With Maya, yeah.
Maya Foa. I am the director of the death penalty team at Reprieve.
Okay, so Maya Foa lives in London, and when she was about 25, she had graduated from college. She was doing some theater things, but she was, like, having this quarter-life crisis and didn't know what to do with her life.
Post-college flail.
Sort of.
An existential crisis, and I wrote to a couple of organizations and said, you know, please, can I be useful to you?
She ends up volunteering at this place called Reprieve.
A legal organization that did death penalty cases.
Are they, like, a bunch of lawyers, or what do they do?
Yeah, like, they do legal work and advocacy. They've been working on the death penalty for like years at that point to try to abolish it.
I view the death penalty, and I viewed it at the time as sort of the sharp end of a series of societal injustices.
So anyway, she's at Reprieve one night. This was 2010.
I was sat in the office and
she's sitting there one night, and Clive Stafford Smith, who's the president of Reprieve, or the head of Reprieve, calls and says,
look, we've got an execution tonight.
There's an execution in Arizona tonight.
Jeffrey Landrigan is set to be put to death for killing Chester Dreyer. Landrigan was found guilty of strangling and stabbing the man in 1989.
So Clive says, there's an execution tonight, and we just found out that the lethal injection drugs that they're going to use...
They came from a pharmacy in England.
But we don't know which pharmacy because Arizona refuses to release the name.
Does anyone in the office have some time, a volunteer, have some time to figure out where those drugs could have come from?
And she raises her hand and she's like, I have 30 minutes, you know.
And I said, yeah, sure, I've got half an hour. You know, I didn't know what I was starting when I started it.
So wait, why do they want to find this supplier? Like, why does that help them?
Well, the drugs that they want to use in Arizona have to be FDA approved. So if they can find who made these drugs and prove that they are not FDA approved, then they can probably stop the execution.
Did they have any reason to think the drugs weren't FDA approved?
It was kind of a Hail Mary.
Ah.
So I started the half-hour research task that has taken me now 5.5 years. And I was trying to figure out, with limited information, where sodium thiopental could have come from in the UK to get to the US.
Sodium thiopental is an anesthetic, and for a long time it was one of the most common anesthetics used in surgeries. But it's also one of the drugs used in lethal injection.
I don't think I knew the purpose of all the research that I was doing, but I was doing it very quickly. because, of course, they had an execution that night.
Landrigan is running out of time and options.
And it was, I was in the UK, so it was the evening.
Which is morning Arizona time.
So we had just a number of hours.
She's, like, frantically searching through all these, like, global medical regulations. And, you know, she can't figure out exactly what the name of the company is.
Because there was no way to know at that point.
But ultimately, she does figure out that there are no UK companies authorized to ship this drug to the US.
There was no, effectively, no FDA-approved supplier of the stuff.
So whatever this mystery pharmacy was, it probably wasn't FDA-approved.
And I remember, you know, I emailed that over. I think we either turned it into an affidavit from me or from Clive.
They write up a quick affidavit. They send it back to the States.
And the execution that night was stayed.
Like halted.
When I went to sleep, it had been stayed. And I just thought, okay, great. You know, we've got a bit of time.
And the next morning,
I woke up. I was couch surfing. I was in someone's home. And I turned on World Service. And they announced that
Jeffrey Landrigan was executed at 22:26 hours.
Yeah.
His final meal was a piece of steak. His last words were, "Well, I'd like to say thank you to my family and Boomer Sooner."
It turned out, while Maya was asleep,
the state appealed all the way to the Supreme Court, and late yesterday, the justices, by a 5-4 vote, lifted the stay of execution, allowing Landrigan to be put to death last night.
The stay was put in place due to concern over lethal injection drugs. One of those drugs obtained from Britain was not FDA approved, but the U.S. Supreme Court did rule that there was no reason to believe that the drug wasn't safe. So, Jeffrey,
you know, talk about a rude awakening in the literal sense.
Now, that rude awakening would send Maya on a journey around the world. It would get her called out by the United States Supreme Court, and it would spark a global conversation about the American death penalty and about those little words, cruel and unusual, that are embedded in our Eighth Amendment.
The Honorable, the Chief Justice, and the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of the United States. Oh, yay, oh, yay, oh, yay. Persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States, are admonished to draw near and give their attention. For the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
All right, back to Karen.
So we were in London with Maya, who just learned that Jeffrey Landrigan had been executed.
Mm-hmm.
But to understand what she does next, let me just give you a little bit of context. In the fall of 2010, when Jeffrey Landrigan was executed, the drug that they'd used,
the lethal drug sodium thiopental,
was suddenly in really short supply.
There was a nationwide shortage.
Because the only U.S. company that still made that drug was having, like, a manufacturing problem. So they had stopped manufacturing or producing this drug. So you actually see these emails between states like, dude, do you have any sodium thiopental?
California got help from right next door. Arizona agreed to lend California a cup of death.
And there's actually this one great email exchange between, like, the California Department of Corrections. They send Arizona this thank you email.
Writing, and I quote, "You guys in Arizona are lifesavers."
We'll buy you a beer next time I see you.
You're a lifesaver.
Yes.
Come on.
Yeah. So when Jeffrey Landrigan is set to be executed, Arizona is out of that drug. And this is how they end up at this mystery drug company in London. So after the execution, Maya is doing all this research. She's calling pharma companies.
Calling through these documents.
And very quickly, she learns that the same company that is sending drugs to Arizona had sent drugs to, like, lots of different states.
Georgia and
South Carolina, Kentucky.
California and various other places.
They'd actually become one of the primary suppliers of lethal injection drugs to the United States.
Wait, tell me again. Why was it so hard to find out information about this company?
So what happens is that anybody involved with an execution, your name is kept confidential. And states have started keeping companies' names confidential, too. Oh,
I see.
So next, she starts calling suppliers and distributors, kind of trying to trace, like, how did this drug get to that company, thinking that maybe that'll lead her to it.
We had figured out it had come originally from, there were some active ingredients made in Austria. Some of those were sent over to Germany. They were packaged, put into vials. Those were sent over to the UK. There was one company that has the marketing authorization for the product. They were sold to another one. That company changed. And then they were sent to this company in England,
which she still can't figure out the identity of. But then the real breakthrough came just a couple months after Jeffrey Landrigan was executed.
I think there was lots of material coming out at that time. I remember California and the ACLU got a batch of documents. And
in one of these batches of documents, she finds an invoice. And this invoice has a name on it.
I just remember getting the court documents, and I was working with this very, very slow internet connection.
She was actually in Malawi at the time.
Just sort of, you know, fervently, you know, willing the computer to download the documents so I could start, you know, looking through them and figuring out this stuff. And those were the documents that had the name of the middleman.
What was it?
Dream Pharma.
Dream Pharma.
Dream Pharma.
Dream Pharma.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So she's in Malawi, so she, you know, rings up her colleague and says, can you go just look at this place? It's in West London. And it's this residential area, but also like with sort of warehouses, kind of middle class.
You have a couple of petrol stations, a couple of cafes, and then this pharmacy, except that it doesn't look like a pharmacy because it's got a big sign on the front that says Elgon Driving Academy.
I'm going to go and try and go and knock on the door of the Elgon Driving Academy.
This is Nina Paris. She's a freelance producer in London.
It doesn't look too good. It's just, there's a
tiny little storefront.
Well, I can't see any evidence of driving.
And if you walk in...
Hello.
Hello.
You walk in, and in the front, it's just this reception area. But in the back...
Hi. I'm looking for Dream Pharma. Is that you? Oh, hi. I'm recording for...
There's a guy sitting at a desk. His name is Mehdi Alavi. He's in his 50s, gray feathered hair, kind of like square glasses, looks a little bit like William Hurt. He is Dream Pharma. In other words, the company that is helping prop up the death penalty system in America.
It's a one-man operation operating out of the back of a driving school.
One guy?
One guy.
And I thought, well, this can't be true.
But they're interested in speaking to you about the injections for that you supplied to the States.
From the get-go, I had no comments, and I still have no comments.
Oh, so what was it like when Reprieve came to find you?
You ask them yourself.
What was it like for you?
Ask them for yourself.
Okay. Are you still... supplying the States with?
No. It's illegal.
Oh, right. Were you aware of that?
It wasn't illegal at that point.
Oh, right. So then it became illegal.
That is correct.
Oh. Would you mind me asking how you came to get involved in that in the first place? How they came to find you or you to find them?
They found me.
They found you? Wow. Were you surprised when they got in contact with you?
Surprised? I don't know at that point.
No, but I guess it unraveled somewhat.
I got no further comments, my dear.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for...
Pleasure.
...for doing that. And thank you for bringing me to Acton, because I very much enjoyed walking around Acton and meeting the people around here.
Okay.
Yeah. So what do you sell now?
It's irrelevant to your case.
Well, I'm just quite interested as a citizen of London.
It's irrelevant to you. You're not in the business. That's irrelevant to you. Okay?
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your
pleasure.
Time.
Pleasure.
And what was your name again, please?
You know my name. If not, find out.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Bye-bye. Do you actually do driving lessons?
It's irrelevant to you.
You don't do driving lessons.
So once Maya and Reprieve found that guy, Mehdi Alavi, in his pharmaceutical broom closet of death, the next step was pretty simple. They went to the UK government and they told them, because in the UK, it's illegal to be part of capital punishment in any way.
We have a law that prohibits exports of products for the facilitation of capital punishment or torture. It's called the torture regulation.
The anti-torture regulation. With this text, unique in the world, the EU is profoundly committed to the fight against torture and the death penalty.
And when they realised that the sole purpose of the exports of this drug was for executions, they put an export control in place.
And just like that, the supply of this drug is turned off.
So the states are just out of luck?
Well, I mean, 60% of Americans support the death penalty, so they're not going to give this up without a fight. And so over the next few years, you have like this arms race. Missouri says, we're going to find the drug in Germany. So Maya goes to Germany. And then she hears that a company called Hospira is about to make the drug in
Italy. And so I spent a bit of time there. The Italian government really didn't want drugs made in the seat of the Pope to be used for executions.
A Hospira spokesperson said, "We cannot take the risk that we will be held liable by the Italian authorities if the product is diverted for use in capital punishment."
And then
Denmark. A bunch of states, you have Florida, Ohio, Alabama, 11 other states. They all decide they're going to get their drug from this
company called Lundbeck.
Maya calls them up.
And I remember my first call with them.
She was like, did you know that your drug's being used in executions? And they were like, what?
It certainly came as a huge surprise for us.
This is Anders Schroll. He's vice president for communications at Lundbeck.
We have been in the pharma industry for a little more than 100 years, and we are here to save people's lives. This was the complete opposite of the intention of this product.
And Maya says that she heard the same thing all over the world, even when states like Nebraska and South Dakota go to India to get their drug.
And it's interesting in India because India has capital punishment. So this isn't an objection to capital punishment. This is, from every company I've spoken to in India, they say, but why? Why would they use medicines?
Like, if you're going to kill someone, just kill them. Why are you using something that saves lives to do it? And actually, there's a really interesting story about why we do it that way.
Oh, yay, oh, yay, oh, yay.
Hope you guys enjoyed that. That was an excerpt of More Perfect, our very first spinoff show about all about the Supreme Court. And that was just the first half of the first episode. To hear the rest of that episode and to hear all the other episodes, subscribe to the series at radiolab.org/moreperfect. I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
Thanks for listening.